Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. George Floyd's family urged civil rights protesters to be his legacy. Family members told thousands at today's Commitment March for Racial Equality in D.C. they have to be the voice and the change. That rally called Get Your Knee Off Our Necks, a reference to George Floyd's police-related death in May. It commemorated the 1963 march on Washington, where the iconic I Have a Dream speech was made by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Well, tonight, we'll talk about the march and some of the other stories impacting African Americans this week. My guests are Erica Savage Wilson, a political analyst, and Dr. Greg Carr, chair of Afro-American Studies here at Howard University. We're talking about it tonight. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Erica, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you all on this historic day.
Absolutely. Dr. Carr, good to hear from you again.
Always good to hear from you. Hope you were staying cool out there, Fish.
I was trying to say safe. That's cool. We can't control staying safe. Definitely an issue. I want to start with Erica. And as she said, this is an historic day. Outside of the obvious, Erica, why do you say that?
Well, we're looking at 57 years since Dr. King graced the podium and several other civil rights icons. And I think it's historic because when we look at the time that we're in right now, everyone well knows that we are in the midst of a global pandemic, one that within the United States has not been contained because of lack of a national strategy by the White House occupants. And that we're facing a number of crises, continued racial reckoning, an economic crisis, a housing crisis, but that we actually bore witness to thousands of people that came to Washington, D.C. Throughout all of that to actually stand in solidarity with the message of get off of our necks. And then we also saw that people were united across many states of this nation to say that we also may not be in D.C., but we stand in solidarity with all of the messaging that is happening today. So the history of this day, I think that people will be able to say where were they on August 28th, 2020, is another kind of marker in history that really furthers the cause of really saying that Black lives do in fact matter and that we are going to ensure that we live in imprint of that it does, in fact, matter.
Dr. Carr, as a student of history, how significant do you believe today was? And indeed, what did it mean to you personally?
Well, as our sister has said, Sister Erica, it's a historical moment. And, you know, rituals reinforce memory. So the March on Washington has had a 25-year celebration, a 30-year celebration. I was there for the 25th. A 50-year celebration, if you remember, President Obama spoke there. And, of course, it takes added significance now because we're in another spate of state violence. All the killings of the mothers and families, brother of George Floyd and others, the father of our most recent victim of state violence in Kenosha, Wisconsin, spoke today, and so many others. In this moment, we've reached another watershed, it seems. And, of course, we know that 65 years ago, Emmett Till was killed in Money, Mississippi. In fact, they were in Jackson, Mississippi today. Councilman Kenneth Stokes in Jackson. They're still trying to prosecute. He was there with the family. They laid a wreath on Mega Everest Boulevard. They're still trying to prosecute Carolyn Bryant. Carolyn Bryant is still alive, the woman who lied on Emmett Till. So what these moments do is not only draw our attention to the crisis of the moment and how we must organize, they remind us through rituals of repetition of where we have been before and the similarities and the differences. Only other thing I would say is that, you know, it's fascinating listening to and very powerful listening to Martin Luther King's only granddaughter, young Yolanda, who spoke at the March for Our Lives, the Young People's March 2 years ago, followed by her father, Dr. King's son. He said, I was 10 years old when my father was taken from me. And he said, if you're looking for a leader, look in the mirror. So this really isn't about specific people and leaders. It's really about people gathering to remember that the work is unfinished.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are at the political roundtable talking about some really important issues that have collided this week in America, all of them pertinent to African Americans. If you have a comment or a question, you can call us at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You certainly are welcome to tweet me at HFisherWHUR or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. I want you to listen to a portion of an interview that I did late this morning when Jacob Blake's father showed up with the family and friends. He was there to speak, and he crossed the path where I and my intrepid producer, Candace Atkins, were. And shout out to Candace for really getting that interview. I didn't get the interview. Candace got it for me. But, you know, I asked the questions. But this is a part of what he said. And I find this whole piece so intriguing.
I'm worried about the two systems of justice that surround us in the United States. Until the system is just, there is no justice.
That's right.
There was a Caucasian young boy, 17 years old, killed two, shot one, blew his arm off, and walked home to Illinois. They gave him a bottle of water and a high five. They gave my son seven in his back.
Seven bullets.
He grabbed my hand. When I went into the hospital, he was squinting. I said, "What's wrong, man? You in pain?" And he said, "No, I thought I was hallucinating." And he grabbed my hand and he just wept. And when he finished crying, he said, "Why did they shoot me so many times? Why?" And I said, "They weren't supposed to shoot you at all, baby."
You know, Erica, when I listen to that, and I get goosebumps, because George Floyd is not here to react to what happened to him. Ahmaud Arbery, not here to react to what happened to him. Rayshard Brooks, not here to react to what happened to him. But, you know, Jacob Blake is. Talk to me about the significance of the fact that he has survived, even in the poor and paralyzed condition that he is in. What does the fact that he is living to tell this tale mean for this moment?
Yeah, I think it means that, you know, for the larger population of Black life, that this is something that we have actually become conditioned to really seeing people within different generations that have really bore witness to the violence of Jim Crow and of systemic racism. But for Jacob Blake to be alive, and first of all, to hear you say the names of the people that have died as a result of police and state violence, really does kind of fill me in a moment. But I think that for Jacob Blake at the tender age of 29, for me, what it does is it really serves as a wake-up call of what I am saying is like the season of complacency that we have been in. And that is not to say that people have not been active, that people have not been pursuing change, and that people have not been really continuing the drumbeat of change, but that we are all really in this moment, in this nation and both globally, of seeing really the bodily impact in real time because of the advent of social media, because of cameras being installed on phones, of seeing the real impact and effect, and seeing that this does not just impact and affect Black and brown bodies, but then people who are also allies of the cause of Black Lives Matter. And so that Jacob Blake's life has been changed, but that he and his family have really turned the corner of not being really given the moment to really grieve and breathe, But like Dr. Carr brought forward Emmett Till's mother and how she made the decision 60 years ago to ensure that her son's funeral and that the condition of his body was telegraphed before the world so that people were able to see the impacts of systemic racism and write out just hatred on the body of her 14-year-old, that we're seeing that being played out in so many different ways with modern technology. So it is definitely very much so impactful. But at the same time, it really does beg the question, what are we going to do with all of the imprints that we are being left with, the scars, the markings, how all of our lives are really being changed by systemic racism, by hatred, and really white violence? What are the individual calls that we're going to step up to answer as a result of what we're seeing? So I think that we've really turned a corner, and it's really a choice of people are either going to be quiet and very complacent, or they're actually going to be activated.
Dr. Carr, you know, Erica just brought up an issue that I need to talk about in full transparency, and I think she just hit the nail on the head, because during the time that I was talking to Jacob Blake's father, I confused his son's incident with George Floyd. And I made a reference to him that he had lost his son. He said, "I didn't lose him. He's still alive." And I apologized. And he said just like he said about his son. He said, "It's okay, baby." But the thing about it was, in confusing that with George Floyd, because in my head also there was a fleeting glimpse of Philando Castile, and then there was the Rayshard Brooks, in my head. And just for a brief moment, while I'm standing there in the heat of this interview with all of these other reporters, my colleagues standing around, it just kind of hit me, as a reporter, but just as a Black man, it's too much.
It is too much, Harold.
It's too happening much. Too much. Who got shot this time?
That's right. And again, let me add my thanks and lift Candace Atkins, who is intrepid indeed. I know both of y'all were out on the mall today. I mean, that sister's always holding it down. It is too much. And not only is it too much for the death, as Brother Blake, Jacob Blake Sr. said from the steps of Lincoln Memorial today, there are two systems. Kyle Rittenhouse, a murderer, cut out of the same cloth, as far as I'm concerned, as Carolyn Bryant, who helped kill Emmett Till 55 years ago. Kyle Rittenhouse drinking water that was handed to him from a surplus army tank there in the streets of Kenosha, Wisconsin, who then took his rifle that he had shown the police and told them it was a real rifle and killed three people the other day. He had been extradited from Illinois to Wisconsin to be arraigned and held trial, even as Jacob Blake Jr. was handcuffed to a rail in his hospital bed where he gets paralyzed from the waist down. Not only is it too much, I think we may, perhaps, hopefully that is, we've crossed the line now. Thank you and Candace for being down there along with everyone else who was on the mall today, because not 24 hours ago, the White House was being used in a direct violation of federal law and protocol by a white nationalist terrorist organization that we call the Republican Party right now, and a liar in chief who spewed dozens of lies from the White House steps, one of which was that he's done more for Black Americans than any president since Abraham Lincoln. So we're living in a moment when the lines have been drawn very clearly. And I don't know that, well, of course, you may not have called the name Jacob Blake in that moment. You may have called Big George Floyd. But what Brother Blake assured you, Blake Sr., was that George Floyd is Philando Castile, is Breonna Taylor, is Sandra Bland, is Trayvon Martin, is Emmett Till, is the victims of lynching from the late 19th and early 20th century that Ida Wells talked about. These are all the same people. And Kyle Rittenhouse is Carolyn Bryant. Carolyn Rittenhouse is Dylann Roof. Kyle Rittenhouse is Donald Trump. In other words, if you're going to be a racist and urge people to violence, if you're going to urge people to go and fight against fellow human beings in the streets of the cities of the United States, then you've decided you're going to stand against humanity. And those were three white people that Kyle Rittenhouse killed, by the way. So when we start talking about
that, they're two dead, one wounded.
I'm sorry. Absolutely. Thank you.
But please go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely right. Two white people he killed, one wounded, none of whom were over 30. Well, one was 36. I think the other two were 26. But young people. So I guess what we're facing now is a decision. That's why, you know, and whether or not you agree with everyone who spoke today, it was very encouraging to see not only politicians, Sheila Jackson Lee brought up reparations, to see the labor unions, although the postal workers weren't allowed to speak, and the time was given to Tom Perez, who should probably be a little bit more worried about getting out the vote than coming to talk to people on steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But ultimately, to see young people, including those brothers and sisters who walked from Delaware, I think people have decided that there's a right and a wrong side of history. There's a bright line, and more people, including the NBA athletes and the young sisters in the WNBA who showed them the way, and many others, they've decided to stand on the right side of that line.
Yeah. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are at the reporters at the political roundtable talking not only about the commitment march today, but we're also going to talk about the wrapping up of the RNC, the Jacob Blake shooting, and all of the incidents that have just kind of come together over the past week or so. All of this important to black folks. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons with the original Quiet Storm is next on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM in just a few seconds. Stay with us. Erica, talk to me about your thoughts referencing Alice Johnson last night in her speech.
Mm-hmm.
And also the news today that President Trump also pardoned her completely today. Your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it kind of goes along with what Dr. Carr was just laying out before us, right? We see this subsequence to actual authoritarianism and fascism. And what really struck me, not more so in words, but in presentation, is that you saw an Alice Johnson who had really been over sentenced on a 1995-1996 drug charge in which she was purported to be this ringleader in a cocaine operation, where she was a woman who lost her job because of a gambling addiction and did what she needed to do, not making that right, but she did what she needed to do to be able to get by, and that was given a lifetime sentence, which is something that we are commonly seeing within black and brown sentencing, but that she was actually in that audience without a mask and sitting very much so close to who I assume to be her attorney. I'm not sure who that gentleman was that was sitting next to her, but really on used as a token and on display to say, well, look what I have done for this, quote, black, really kind of support this particular regime, which is, as Dr. Carr has said, is a white nationalist supremacist regime. So I think that, you know, definitely imagery definitely does have an impact on how people kind of make decisions and see things. But I think that what it does is really diminishes the full life that an Alice Johnson should have been afforded to have lived were it not for the way the criminal justice system continues to over-police, continues to over-sentence people who are of black and brown capacity for really what amounts to continuing on slave labor. I was completely sad for her, definitely happy that she indeed is free, as she should have been many, many years ago when you look at her counterparts who are charged with cocaine charges. But it really did speak to that this administration understands that they don't have any chance of winning a fair and free election. So they're pulling out all of the stops to really, as Dr. Carr has already pointed out, really peel off a small percentage of those black voter populations to make people feel better about actually casting a ballot for what really amounts to just really authoritarianism. And as Dr. Carr said, a power grab, power at all costs.
You know, Erica,
and don't use anybody to do that.
You know, one of the things that really struck me last night, I don't know what Alice Johnson's politics were before Kim Kardashian went to the White House and brought her case to President Trump. But I was conflicted because, and I think a lot of the commentators last night were just as conflicted. I did not watch Fox News, but I did look at some of the other news programs, and I think everybody was really conflicted about Alice Johnson because of, like you said, she should have been out of prison a long, long time ago.
Absolutely.
And if it were not for this, if it weren't for President Trump, she would probably still be there. And so as a result, who would not offer, you know, high praise for Donald Trump if he were to release you from prison that you have been sentenced to for essentially the rest of your life? And, you know, and I really often question, you know, I'm not going to question the sincerity of black Republicans. They believe what they believe. And as I've said on this program before, there's nothing wrong with being a black Republican, nothing wrong with being a black conservative. But where we are, I think, right now, when all of these other things, and the polls even say that, you know, more than 50% of Americans polled believe that Donald Trump is a racist. It was just a really difficult thing for me to watch last night.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because what it seemed is, though, it was a part of a whole choir of fealty to this occupant of the White House. And absolutely, Alice Johnson has, you know, every right to feel that the way that she feels. But I think on the other side, for all of us that were watching the convention, the Dr. Carrs of the world, you, all of us that are very much so connected to politics, it was difficult to really digest it because mm-hmm. we understood that this was really a part of his production. This was all production. This was not connected to empathy. This was not connected to a real need for justice. This was in much of the imagery that we saw when we saw the Citadel cadets that were forced to be present for Donald Trump to give his speech. We saw this as all a part of him in his propaganda campaign to say, look at what I've done for these groups of people. And within that group of people are marginalized people who have been historically oppressed that are continued to be used as billboards to say, and this is what I have done for you. So Alice definitely, Ms. Johnson definitely deserves her freedom, a woman that is in her 60s. That has children and grandchildren, but the way with which she was used to continue to further an agenda and the way that she's been used is really unfair to all of us. Understanding that this was something that only Donald Trump was interested in is using as a prop and really to further his cause of securing the White House for many, many years to come.
You know, Dr. Carr, we saw the NBA on Wednesday put, and specifically LeBron James, you know, of the Lakers, lead a movement that made not just the NBA, but all the professional sports in America stop and pay attention. The last time that this was really done with different kinds of outcomes was when Colin Kaepernick was still playing and kneeling. But in your opinion, is this the John Carlos Tommy Smith moment for professional sports in America, that 1968 fist raised moment?
You know, Harold, that's a great question. I think the times are different. And I do think, however, that the behavior of these young women and men now does reflect the tenor of the time. And there are similarities, even as they're different. In 1968, of course, the United States is in Vietnam. Muhammad Ali is taking his famous stand. If you remember, everyone from then Lou Alcindor, now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Brown, another famous meeting in Cleveland, Bobby Mitchell of the Washington Football Club went out to support Ali. And so the Mexico City Olympics of 1968, I think, captured the tenor of that time. And in that period, late 60s through the early 70s, you see a number of athletes, Arthur Ashe, of course, Ali again in 1974 in Zaire, fighting in Africa. It captured the tenor of that Black Power moment. Now, fast forward to now, and I think you're seeing a kind of similar moment. Not the same, but similar. And so, you know, it's interesting the fact that the NBA has agreed to convert all the arenas in the various cities in which they play to polling places for the upcoming election. And that, at least is being reported, as you know, was an agreement reached between the NBA and its players' union, because these young brothers were deciding, Lakers and the Clippers said, we're not going to play again. And so I do think that that is a similarity. And what you're seeing is, as they study, as they become aware of previous sacrifices and previous efforts, these young brothers and sisters, and again, I must mention the WNBA, of course.
Of course.
Perhaps the greatest player, woman or man, to play in professional basketball right now. Maya Moore took a whole year off to get someone exonerated. They are using their platform. Naomi Osaka, who the press loves to call Japanese, when she has a Haitian side of her family, said, I'm not playing tennis because I am a Black woman. You know, this is a seismic shift, and I think finally what it did is scared the hell, Harold and Eric, it scared the hell out of professional sports, because these are the folks who are typically treated as privileged. And when Chris Paul said in the wake of the negotiated settlement yesterday that, yeah, we get paid pretty good money, but we Black. You know, that sends a message. And yes, yeah, so this isn't Alice Johnson, who is basically a hostage. And no, I don't give Donald Trump any credit, Harold, about that pardon. You know, they call the pardon power the benign prerogative. He's used it 36 times to grant pardons and commutations, mostly to his punk convicted criminal friends like Roger Stone. And this woman was a hostage. There was a hostage case. I don't care what her politics are. She's grateful to be out. She shouldn't have been in. And Trump decided that he's a king, and we, if we live in a government of laws, even if the president can do whatever the hell he wants in this area, we should say, no, you are not a king. So therefore, on a whim, you don't just commute her because she was star in the crowd. And no. Get this guy out of the paint, and let's restore some semblance of the law, because he's turning this into some type of monarchy with an eye toward totalitarianism. And these players are drawing a line as well.
We march a lot when it comes to issues of injustice in the African-American community. That action is deeply rooted in our history, Erica. And yet, often it is an emotional, a muscular, a eardrum-shattering and heart-rending experience. But do you believe that that will transform itself into the work that needs to be done to move many of these issues forward? You know, voting rights, police reform, more broadly, criminal justice reform, all of these issues, because the reality is that African Americans and brown people are still a minority in this community, and even if they all vote, there may be other communities that either are tone deaf, don't understand, don't want to understand, or don't believe they can understand. And so therefore, there is the risk that we could see a 2016 in November of 2020.
I mean, I certainly hope that this is a turning point, because I think where we are now is very much so different than where we have been in the past, because this is actually the last stand. So this is the last opportunity to really regain some semblance of democracy in our country. You know, those of us who are very much so dug in into politics, these are things that we understand. But for so many years, and it goes back to what I was sharing around complacency, you know, when I look at it, folks like, you know, Diane Nash and Jesse Jackson, Reverend Jesse Jackson, they should not still be having to hold up the banner. It is actually this present generation, Xennials, Gen X, and those generations that really should be moving and keeping the baton moving towards civil rights. And so I think that because the messaging has been that, you know, every election has been consequential, in which to say for Black and brown communities, it definitely has been for all the different election years. But this time, having a person that is actually in office because of, first and foremost, Russian interference. Mm. Russian interference played a hefty role in him being ascended to the People's House at 1600 Black Lives Matter Plaza. But then also when we see that the voter apathy, the oppression, we have generations of people, and I don't tend to use the word minority. I like to say that we are oppressed, because in no way are African Americans minor in any sense, and that is just my interpretation of the language, but that there has been hundreds of years of so much oppression, of really kind of keeping hope alive, so to speak, to borrow a phrase from Reverend Jesse Jackson, that there have been so many years of that where it seems like there's really no opportunity or no real chance for us to really shift history in a really demonstrative way. However, this is really the opportunity to do that. And because we have a person who is mediocre at best, a person who was impeached by the House in December of 2019 because he literally attempted, not just only with the government of Ukraine, but with China and other countries, to really say, please involve yourself in our politics. Bring as much dirt as you can on who I believe to be my opponent for the 2020 election, because that is the only way that we can win. When you think about a Nixon, and then you think about a now Donald Trump, it has moved the post goal to a whole different place. And so that because we're in this place, because there are so many people that really don't have a real grasp on authoritarianism, they don't have a real grasp on oligarchies, they don't have a real grasp on what it means to be absolutely controlled by a government, that has taken folks by storm. And that because there's not been a lot of messaging around how it is that we combat this outside of Black communities understanding what, you know, something is wrong in the water, that we're somewhat woefully unprepared, and we're kind of in this ninth inning, bases loaded, the bottom, where now there's this real rush to really reinvigorate, try to solve some issues, and really get people who did not engage in the 2016 election, albeit because of voter suppression, because of apathy, because really not seeing the change that they heard preached for decades and decades, that now we're at a critical hour. And the decision is very much so individual and collective. So I'm really hoping with what Dr. Carr laid out, with the WNBA, the NBA athletes, people who have great power, who have great influence, and with folks who are engaged in the body politics to be involved, that we hopefully will see some change within the next 66 days.
You know, one of the things that I find really surprising is, and this is almost off topic, is, you know, I was really kind of watching the Jerry Falwell Jr. situation fall apart at Liberty University. And that when you talk about, you know, when he's, you know, and people are human, I get that. Okay. Now that I've gotten that, and I'm not dancing on his grave, but to see that someone who has been such a such a supporter of the president, and to see what has happened and why he has lost his post at Liberty, where, you know, his wife had an affair and there are allegations of, you know, the involvement in the, you know, with the young man that they were, you know, involved in. And I just really kind of, you know, find it all, you know, fascinating, because we look at President Trump's personal history. And, you know, Christian conservatives, so-called evangelicals, you know, Dr. Carr, you know, support him. And, you know, in the end, you know, it really, to me, it is not about, and you know, evangelicals really believing that he was sent by God. This is just about race, because any other person who is as imperfect as Donald Trump is in his personal life, I would argue black or white, would not have gotten the pass from evangelicals that he has gotten in 2016 or in the month of August.
No, absolutely. Absolutely, Harold. This is a mistake we make when we think about the United States of America. It's not a nation. It's a country. It's a state with rules and order. But it's really a state with many different nations in it and many different groups with different interests. When the press generally reports and says, you know, the Christian evangelical, no, white Christian evangelical, as you said, it's race. They don't care what Donald Trump does. Serial cheater on his wives, a man who broke the law in his wife, you know, and then backmapped it so that her immigration status could be changed. The only first lady in American history to pose nude. Right. For public consumption. This doesn't bother them at all. We saw a nun two nights ago shake hands with the devil because she's a single-issue nun. Her issue is abortion. And they are counting on Donald Trump to continue to support to appoint federal judges to transform the bench. So that also ties into the racist work of probably the primary speechwriter for that speech last night, which contained so many lies. Mm. Your colleague at CNN, Dale, what's his name? Mr. Dale, Daniel Dale chronicled over 20 of the lies in about 30 seconds, it seemed, the other night. But they're not concerned about whether he's a liar or not. And in terms of Falwell, right. Falwell's wife, Becky, and the pool boy, Giancarlo Granda, who said he had an affair with her, they don't care about any of that. This is about, right. Can our interests be promoted? Donald Trump, as far as that narrative goes, is part of a larger white evangelical fantasy about everything from the Armageddon to the war between Satan and God to the coming back of Jesus. That's why Mike Pompeo stood on a roof in Jerusalem earlier this week to signal.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
But, of course, Israel has an agenda as well. They're trying to protect their national security. So they're going to shake hands with the devil because the white evangelical Christians think Jesus is coming back and part of it's going to be a war in the Middle East. And so Pompeo is not for them either. But this is all a marriage of convenience. And what's wrong with black America? We seem to have forgotten that. You wave a flag in front of us, we seem to think it's about patriotism and fidelity to the American project and the greatest country, and we can perfect it, an American experiment. Y'all better go somewhere and read some history. Everybody's out for themselves. Negroes, stop sacrificing yourselves for a fantasy, because everybody else going to get what they can get.
You know, and that's, you know, one of the things that when I was watching some of the attacks by, you know, surrogates, GOP surrogates this week against, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And Kamala Harris is a conundrum for the GOP because they try to parse the details, for example, of the 1994 crime bill. But, you know, Erica, one of the things that people forget, you know, okay, you know, Joe Biden voted for the crime bill. There were a whole lot of black people who voted for that crime bill.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Because, as I said on this program a couple of weeks ago, when that, you know, when it comes up and when we have, you know, our, you know, black Republican friends on this program, and they bring this up. I said, blood was running in the street in major cities, in you know, not just in, you know, challenged black communities, but in, you know, middle class, you know, black communities where you had law-abiding, hardworking black mm-hmm. folks who were afraid of crime.
Yep.
This, you know, and so this wasn't just, you know, white politicians, Joe Biden and others like him, trying to lock up black folks, the three strikes you're out or what have you. You had a lot of black folks were saying, if you do this in my neighborhood more than twice, you should be locked up.
Yep.
And I think that's one of the things that people have really, really forgotten, and they can't say, you know, Kamala Harris is soft on crime. She was a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. This is a really, really big fight. And like Dr. Carr said, Erica, people need to do their homework.
Yeah, you get it on the nail, hit the nail on the head, brother. And when you said people have forgotten, that was being generous. I just would say that people don't know, and they're going off of meme culture, what they've heard. Even when you look at the state level, the executive level, mayors, state legislators, were really pushing for this particular crime bill. For those people who are part of the progressive wing, Bernie Sanders also was a defender of this crime bill as well. So when we kind of move forward past that to see that, you know, there were many people that were complicit in this particular crime bill because of, you look at where we were coming out of, you're talking about a war that was declared again on black communities in the war on drugs. And so
yes.
Black people were coming out of that era of crack being dropped down into our neighborhoods, of young women and men that were selling crack. It was easy, hot money. And the destructions that happened within our neighborhoods, the tearing down of families, and the furthering and the building of wealth through mass incarceration that came out of that. So there were many people whose hands, if you want to say, kind of had blood on them during that time. But kind of as we move forward, the piece that where you talked about of people needing to do their homework, you know, we're kind of in this hour where, again, we have 66 days until November the 3rd, but substantially less time than that when we look at early voting, we look at deadlines for people to actually register to vote, and then when we look at absentee ballots and things of that nature, it's significantly less time depending on the municipality that people are in. And so there's a lot that is being crammed into a very, very late hour.
Yeah.
And because Russian interference was so successful in 2016 and